things like that that we don't see. It's malnutrition. It's not being able to get clean water, get to the hospital on time because you don't have gas in your car. And so CEPR looked at just a period 1 year between 2017 and 2018 and said that the U.S.'s economic war against Venezuela contributed to the death of 40,000 Venezuelans. And that's just 1 year period.
U.S. sanctions can be as lethal as bombs.
A dangerous international schism, permanently headed and instigated by the United States, is being promoted. Through the pernicious use and abuse of economic coercive measures, which have become the instrument defining the foreign policy of the United States,
Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel described U.S. aggression toward Cuba in the form of unilateral coercive measures, also known as economic sanctions.
I was at an IDP camp yesterday, and I was documenting an aid organization, a local aid organization, feeding people at this IDP camp. And when the guy heard that I was American, he said, I don't want to talk to him. And so my escorts had to explain, like, no, he is here for you. He's here to talk about the IDP situation. He is basically a neutral, objective journalist. Mm-hmm. And so then the guy, he opened up to me. You know, mm-hmm. we talked him off the ledge, but, you know, he basically said, I don't even want to hear the word America because Americans have done so much damage to this situation.
The U.S. threatens Ethiopia and its ally Eritrea with sweeping sanctions.
We want the American people to stand with us. We don't deserve this. Rana in Damascus.
Voices from the 39 countries, more than a third of the world's population, now subjected to U.S. sanctions. This and more in today's COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and affiliate stations. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. What are sanctions? The EU and US pass laws to ban, block, or restrict trade to a specific country, group, or individual when they do not comply with US and EU foreign policy. Currencies are devalued and inflated when sanctions are levied. International credit ratings tank, and countries are pressured to stop doing business with sanctioned countries. The first sectors affected are usually medicines, the cost of food, power, water treatment, and other essential human needs. Because the United States holds trade, banking, and military dominance in most of the world, U.S. sanctions have killed millions of vulnerable people. These sanctions violate international law, the UN Charter, and the Geneva and Nuremberg Conventions because they target civilians by economic strangulation, creating famines, life-threatening shortages, and economic chaos. That's the Sanctions Kill Coalition's summary description of sanctions at sanctionskill.org. In today's show, we'll look into specific examples. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a medical doctor, co-chair of the Sanctions Kill Coalition, and co-founder of Popular Resistance, a resource and information clearinghouse for anti-capitalist and social justice movements. I spoke to her about sanctions in Latin America.
Margaret Flowers, you're particularly knowledgeable about sanctions on Latin American nations that the U.S. doesn't like. Could you give us some specifics about Venezuela?
Sure. Well, Venezuela, the real economic war in Venezuela began under the Obama administration in 2015 when Obama declared them a national security threat. And that really started to dry up economic investment in that country because the big companies saw what was coming down the pike. And then President Trump waged this all out, quote unquote, maximum pressure war on Venezuela. And so the United States has seized Venezuela's assets. They have $342 million in our country, I think, in the Federal Reserve that the U.S. is refusing to give to them. We seized their oil company, Citgo. U.S. allies like Portugal and the United Kingdom are refusing to give Venezuela its assets. So, for example, Venezuela has, I think, about $2 billion worth of gold in the Bank of London. And last year, when the pandemic began, Venezuela had a negotiation with the United Nations to use that gold to purchase medicines and food for its people. And the Bank of England is refusing to release that money. So that's kind of an example. There's others where, like, the the Venezuela has qualified for money from the International Monetary Fund that they're refusing to give to Venezuela. Or another one related to COVID-19 is that the World Health Organization created this program called COVAX so that poorer countries could purchase COVID-19 vaccines. And despite the fact that Venezuela was able to get the money together to pay into the COVAX program to get vaccines, a Swiss bank, UBS, refused to do those financial transactions so that they could get that money into the COVAX program and get those vaccines. And I think under pressure, they finally were able to do that, but it was months and months and months of delay. And then another one is just so egregious. One of the Venezuelan diplomats, Alex Saab, was traveling to Iran to negotiate the purchase of food and medicine. He needed to refuel his plane. Somehow he got diverted to Cabo Verde, but not a place he was intending to stop, a U.S.-dominated small country off the coast of Africa. And that happened a year ago, June in 2020. And Cabo Verde detained him, saying that he was going to be violating U.S. sanctions by doing business with Iran. And the U.S. is trying to extradite him to try him here on charges that have already been found that there's no basis for them.
That you can't charge a sanctioned country for attempting to trade with another sanctioned country.
Well, one, he's a diplomat, so he's got diplomatic immunity. And two, the U.S. is accusing him of money laundering. And that was investigated and found that there's no there, that he didn't launder money. But the whole point is that he was going to go buy food and medicine for a sanctioned country. And that violated the U.S.'s policy of trying to blockade Venezuela's economy. And the whole point of this is regime change in Venezuela. They're trying to make life so painful for the average Venezuelan that they'll rise up against their government, or as the U.S. did in Chile in the 1970s when Allende was president, and trying to make the economy scream. And while the U.S. in the media, well, they'll say, oh, well, these are targeted, these are smart, we have humanitarian exceptions that exclude food and medicines. In reality, this really harms every person in the country, access to food, access to medicines, vaccines for children. All of that is blocked. And this is collective punishment. This is a crime against humanity.
Let's talk about oil. Venezuela has more oil than any other country in the world, but it has a fuel shortage. What's that about?
Yeah, it's an extreme fuel shortage. You know, I was down there in December of last year as an election observer, and people were waiting in line for days to get their car filled with gas. It hurts their transportation, their ability to get patients to the hospital. And yeah, this despite the fact that they have the largest oil reserves, it's because their oil is very thick and they need to have some sort of a diluent that they add to it in order to refine it. Plus, they need the parts to maintain their refinery equipment. And because of the economic blockade, they're not able to purchase the things that they need to process that oil.
And Iran sent them an oil tanker or several oil tankers, right?
Right. Yeah. So, and this was an amazing act of defiance against the U.S.'s sanctions. And the first time that a country really stood up so strongly against the U.S. sanctions, they sent four tankers in the spring of 2020 that carried the oil they needed to dilute their oil, as well as parts for their refineries. And at that time, the U.S. had deployed a tremendous amount of the Navy into that area, the largest deployment in 30 years to those waters. And so Iran was going to traverse these waters that have U.S. naval ships to deliver these supplies to Venezuela. I know the Venezuelan military went out as far as it could to its boundaries in the water so it could escort those Iranian ships in. And this created a real tension, and nobody really knew what was going to happen. Would the U.S. actually try to stop these Iranian ships? They let those four ships go through, but then some months later, Iran sent two more ships, and those were seized in the Middle East. They never really got very far. And the U.S. then took that oil and sold it for $40 million. So kind of piracy.
The fact that there's so much at stake makes it less than funny, but it's still kind of funny that U.S. basically acting like a pirate, using self-righteous grounds to steal $40 million worth of oil and then sell it.
Right, from Iran, which has also been under U.S. economic coercive measures since its revolution in 1979. And I was in Iran in early 2019, and it's really impacting the population there as well. But yet they were showing this amazing solidarity.
Okay, now let's talk about Cuba. Tell us about Cuba.
Yeah, so Cuba is one of the longest economic blockades imposed by the U.S. It's been more than 60 years, and this has resulted in tremendous financial loss to the country. They've had to really struggle to be able to meet their basic needs, which they've done a very good job of considering the circumstances. But under the Trump administration, he imposed 243 new economic measures against Cuba. And this was, you know, after Obama had started to kind of open up relations, reestablish relations with Cuba. I think he was trying to introduce more capitalism and win people over that way. But Trump imposed all these new sanctions. They ended up costing Cuba about $20 billion during Trump's 4 years in office. Biden could undo those 243 measures, but he has not to date, despite the fact that people have asked him to do that. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, this has really caused a strain on Cuba. Initially, they were doing very well because they have a very community-based healthcare system. They were able to get to people, educate them, try to prevent the spread. But even doing things like trying to purchase ventilators early on, they were not able to do because banks wouldn't process the financial transactions. Companies were afraid to sell to them. And this is like Cuba has been sending out the Henry Reeve Medical Brigade all over the world to help countries treat their COVID-19 patients. When Italy was really suffering early on, the Cuba sent doctors and other health professionals there to help them. But yet here, Cuba is under this economic blockade. And even just getting syringes, they created their own vaccines. They've done tremendous work on developing vaccines that the U.S. could benefit from if we had a cooperative relationship with them. But they have created their own effective COVID-19 vaccine. They don't have the syringes to administer them.
There was some solidarity action to take syringes to Cuba, right?
Yeah, very recently, solidarity organizations and individuals outside of Cuba were able to gather up about 8.7 million syringes. And then they used the Mexican Navy to transport those syringes. And Mexico sent other supplies to Cuba as well. Because if they tried to get a commercial ship to do it, because of the economic blockade, any commercial ship that would deliver goods to Cuba then would not be able to enter a U.S. port for 6 months. So Mexico really stood up and used their Navy to get these supplies. And we're starting to see this real solidarity between Cuba and Mexico, which to me is amazing because Mexico is so close to the United States that to defy the U.S., that's a very brave thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nicaragua.
I was there in March of this year on a delegation with the Sanctions Kill Coalition to study the impacts of the U.S. economic war there. What's interesting is that the economic war in Nicaragua is relatively new. In 2018, in the spring of 2018, the U.S. attempted a coup against President Daniel Ortega, very violent, months and months long, these violent blockades throughout Nicaragua. That failed. So in December of 2018, the Congress passed the NICA Act, which put a blockade into foreign investment into Nicaragua. And then right now, because there's a presidential election coming up this November 7th, Daniel Ortega is expected to win re-election overwhelmingly. And the U.S. is doing everything it can to try to undermine that. They, in July, imposed all sorts of travel restrictions against political leaders and judicial leaders in Nicaragua. But Congress is right now pushing through this Renacer Act, which would further put more of an economic blockade on Nicaragua.
And how many lives have been lost? Does anyone even have an estimate of how many lives have been lost because of sanctions?
Yeah, there have been some studies looking at the impacts in North Korea. The Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. did a study looking at Venezuela. You know, this is the interesting thing, and that's what we call our coalition Sanctions Kill, because sanctions are just as deadly as military warfare, but the deaths are less visible. It's not like dropping a bomb and killing a bunch of people or a drone strike, you know, where it knocks out a whole family in Afghanistan. These are deaths due to not being able to get medication. That's another thing about Venezuela, is that they have hundreds of cancer patients that they sent out of the country to places that could treat their cancers the best. And because of the sanctions, they can't pay for that treatment. So these patients are stranded outside the country, as well as there's a number of patients in the country who need to go abroad to get treatment and can't do that. So it's things like that that we don't see. It's malnutrition. It's not being able to get clean water, get to the hospital on time because you don't have gas in your car. And so CEPR looked at just a period 1 year between 2017 and 2018 and said that the U.S.'s economic war against Venezuela contributed to the death of 40,000 Venezuelans. And that's just 1 year period.
Is there any barter going on that you know of?
That's a good question. I don't know of barter going on, but what I do know, and this is something that is a consequence of the U.S.'s economic war that we don't talk about, and this is a consequence of the U.S. sanctions that we don't talk about, that they actually isolate the U.S. financially and politically and in terms of trade, which hurts us in the United States. And so there are efforts to bypass and circumvent the global financial system that uses dollars by creating alternatives. So the European Union developed this program called INSTEX with Iran so that they could trade with Iran outside of the U.S. dollar system.
Didn't that upset the U.S. that the EU did that?
Oh, I'm sure it did, but they basically said we're going to use it for humanitarian purposes only.
Okay.
And the U.S. is like always saying how we have these humanitarian exceptions. So I think it put the U.S. in a position, very difficult position.
Okay. Lastly, I know that one of the best ways to resist sanctions is to develop food security or what's often called food sovereignty, meaning that a nation can feed its people. It is producing enough food to prevent any famine because you can't import food. Do you know how well any of these three countries, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, are doing at this?
Yes, actually. So yeah, Cuba has been forced into the position of producing their food. But Nicaragua, going back to the beginning of the Sandinista revolution in the 1970s, they understood that having food sovereignty was a necessity if you were going to stand up to imperialist countries like the United States. And so they have developed a tremendous amount of food sovereignty. 90% of the food in Nicaragua is grown, produced inside of the country. They've also got basically energy sovereignty. I think 70% of their energy is produced through clean energy in the country. So it'll be interesting to see. And that's kind of one of the reasons we went down there to study, because it's a unique situation where the sanctions are early and they have these systems in place. Venezuela has really been working on that as well. It's difficult because they can't get the inputs that they need for their agriculture. But the times that I've been down there, everybody you talk to, they have a Ministry of Urban Agriculture, which is amazing. Right. And in cities like Caracas, they're growing food everywhere they can. You meet people and everybody wants to show you, oh, look, I'm growing these tomatoes on my balcony. Everybody's growing food in the country anywhere that they can.
Oh, that's great. Did you tell me how close Cuba came? Or?
Yeah, I don't know the actual percentage of their food that they produce themselves, but I know that Cuba, because the blockade has been so long, I mean, they have been forced to really produce so much of what they need inside of the country, as well as just finding ways to make things work without being able to get the parts. Like in Venezuela, you know, when you stay in the hotel, they may have like 4 to 6 elevators, but they'll only have 1 or 2 of them running because they save the other ones so they can use those parts to keep those 1 or 2 elevators. You know, they have real difficulties with their water infrastructure, keeping that running because they can't get the parts to keep that going.
Well, I think one thing the sanctions do inadvertently is to stimulate local industry and creativity.
Right. Yeah. And they drive countries to be able to develop their own goods. And you see this, other countries are talking about this as well, Russia and others and China, how they can't just always rely on trade. They need to be really sovereign in these areas. And it's interesting because even the United States knows this when you read the reports, because this economic warfare has been used increasingly since I think like the 1980s or 90s. The Pentagon knows that they don't work. They know that what they actually do is drive greater solidarity within the country, because you may have political differences inside of a country, but when they're under attack by the United States and it's impacting everyone and their ability to get their basic necessities or get investment or in businesses, grow their industries, it really unites them against the United States. Zimbabwe, you know, which is another African country that has been sanctioned by the United States for a very long time. And in fact, a third of the countries that the United States is targeting economically are in Africa. We don't talk about this enough, but I know I was recently doing a webinar and there was a representative from Zimbabwe, and they're doing a lot there to build up their own industries to have resistance to the U.S.'s economic war.
Margaret Flowers, thank you for speaking to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Thank you for inviting me in.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-chair of the Sanctions Kill Coalition, sanctionskill.org. The coalition also includes the International Action Center, Black Alliance for Peace, United National Anti-War Coalition, Code Pink, and many more. That was Work for Peace by Gil Scott-Heron. Dr. Kee B. Park is a Harvard Medical School neurosurgeon who volunteers in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, otherwise known as North Korea. He spoke during a 2020 Sanctions Kill webinar.
I should point out that I do not represent the government of DPRK on this issue. I am a U.S. citizen of Korean heritage. I've worked alongside North Korean doctors since 2007. And I have seen firsthand the harmful impact the sanctions have had on the ability of the North Korean doctors to care for their patients. And as an academic, I've studied and published extensively on how these sanctions are harming the most vulnerable population of North Korea, despite stating that they're not intended to harm ordinary people. So I would like to make four key points. First is sanctions kill. Our research has shown that as many as 4,000 North Korean people, mostly children under 5 years of age, may have died in 2018. And this is a result of the U.S.-led sanctions and the maximum pressure policies. As this estimate was only looking at the UN agency's programs and did not include the other NGOs that work inside North Korea, it is likely to be an underestimate. The actual number is probably much higher. The second point I'd like to make is that the sanctions hurt the DPRK doctors and hospitals' ability to care for their patients. And let me explain. The North Korean doctors are trying to do the best they can with increasingly scarce resources. So I'm a surgeon and I operate inside North Korea, and I perform surgeries with gauze and scalpel, which have been re-sterilized over and over again until they become unusable. The hospitals face insurmountable barriers for importing parts or repairing their medical equipment. I'll give you an example. During one of my recent visits, an X-ray machine we used to localize the spine during surgery was broken, and it was unable to repair it because of the sanctions, making it impossible to acquire these parts. Let me walk you through this process of getting a part for these equipment. First, the North Korean doctors have to find a vendor willing to sell the part to a North Korean person. Good luck with that. Due to U.S. Treasury actions and the sanctions, no major medical device company will do business with anyone from North Korea. But let's just say if they were able to find a broker, a middleman, who's willing to take the risk, then the North Koreans have to actually send hard currency, which is in short supply, to the seller. Good luck trying to find a bank that's willing to allow transfer of funds from North Korea into any bank outside of North Korea. Then let's say even if that's successful and there was a purchase completed, they have to get this item through the Chinese customs at the border, or the alternative is to they have to smuggle it in. So these doctors simply do not have the means to navigate these impossible barriers, so the equipment remains unrepairable. And ultimately, the North Korean people, the patients who need medical care, suffer. My third point is that the sanctions actually have a disproportionate impact on the women of North Korea. I was part of a group of authors who put a report out on the gendered impact of sanctions in North Korea. And I'll give you one example. The current sanctions cap the import of refined petroleum by North Korea to 500,000 barrels per year. I think that the panelists from Iran and also Venezuela will know how little this amount is, 500,000 barrels per year. To put that in perspective, Australia, which actually is a petroleum-producing country, they import about the same amount each day, and they have the same population. So this limit to petroleum puts a more enormous strain on the agricultural sector by incapacitating the mechanized farming implements. They all need fuel. The North Korean women, who are the main farm laborers, will bear the brunt of the increase in physical labor. And then fourth, I would like to make a point that the sanctions shackled the humanitarian aid organizations from delivering aid inside North Korea. On one hand, these organizations have simply packed up and left, rather than having to navigate the complex regulatory and financial barriers to operate effectively. Two organizations I'll name. One is Handicap International. You all know it's an organization devoted to improving the lives of disabled and has done so much for the disabled people of North Korea. They left. The Finnish government-funded NGO, FIDA, which has been working on food security since 2001, also called it quits recently. On the other hand, the organizations that are actually remaining, they face tremendous challenges in, one, raising the money for their programming, and also to bring in funds for their operating and also shipping their supplies. To give you an idea, the UN agency's annual appeal to meet the most urgent humanitarian needs in North Korea last year was only partially funded. They had asked for $120 million, but received only 25%. And on top of these funding gaps, these organizations face having to apply for exemptions from the UN Security Council Sanctions Committee, finding a banking channel to process this transaction, and also finding ways to ship the cargo into North Korea. And I will tell you, these official UN agencies sometimes have to resort to shady channels to operate inside North Korea. So the question I was asked was, has the COVID-19 pandemic changed anything? Well, the U.S. actually still insists that aid organizations ask for permission before sending COVID-19 response supplies. Now, to be fair, they have streamlined the process and are approving these requests in record time, sometimes in days. But simply the fact that humanitarian organizations have to ask for permission to deliver help in times of a global public health emergency is not only absurd, but it's immoral. And increasingly, these sanctions are being flouted post-COVID. Two examples, both China and Russia have sent supplies, such as diagnostic kits and personal protective equipment, without going through the exemptions process at the UN Security Council. So how has DPRK responded? So some of you may know that they have a philosophy called Juche philosophy, which all has to do with self-sufficiency. And true to their philosophy, they're determined to be self-sufficient as much as possible. So I'll give you some examples. The North Koreans are now manufacturing their own medical equipment. For instance, ultrasound machines. They're designed, manufactured, and distributed for domestic use. They actually have things like artificial knee joints that are manufactured inside North Korea and implanted in people with knee problems. They're also building hospitals. You've seen in the news, Pyongyang General Hospital is a massive construction project that should be completed this year. They're also opened a fertilizer plant, as I think some of you have seen this month, and a medical oxygen plant. And this is no surprise because COVID-19, as you know, is a respiratory disease, and they need massive amounts of oxygen, and now they want to produce their own oxygen. So these are some of the ways the North Korean government is responding to the sanctions. So in closing, I will say that the sanctions have become a favorite tool for the U.S. in achieving its foreign policy objectives. Now, while these sanctions are not intended to harm ordinary people, it is clear that they do. So as an American, the question I have is, to what extent are we willing to put the lives of innocent women and children at risk in the name of national interest? And more broadly, and as a human being, how can we in this world better protect the most vulnerable and the marginalized from the actions of the most powerful country in the world?
That was Harvard Medical School neurosurgeon Dr. Ki B. Park, speaking at a 2020 Sanctions Kill webinar. The entire webinar is on the Sanctions Kill website, sanctionskill.org. We don't deserve this. The impact and consequences of U.S. sanctions is the title of a new report from the Sanctions Kill Coalition published in September. It includes testimonies from people who live in countries impacted by U.S. economic warfare. Here's some of what they had to say, voiced by Pacifica staff.
Due to the lack of fuel, we are not able to generate the electrical energy that is needed. This leads to blackouts. This affects the civilian population because it can ruin the food that is refrigerated, which people have spent much work to acquire. The blackouts and starting, stopping can damage all types of electrical equipment, and their replacement is very difficult given the lack of spare parts. Rosaida, medical doctor from Cuba.
The embargo that Biden is enforcing, what we here in Cuba call the blockade, is a cruel policy designed to make our lives miserable. The US government is like a cop with its knee on our throat. We can't breathe. Sure, there is a lot to criticize about Cuba. It's not perfect, and no one says it is. Not even the Cuban government. But those who criticize Cuba now remind me of the people who talked about George Floyd's supposed character flaws to justify a policeman slowly killing him, while other police officers stood by and watched with guns drawn. A blockade is an act of war, so is it now time to analyze Cuba's problems versus its virtues? To stand by with your hands folded and watch, or to do something to actually get the boot off the neck of us Cuban people? Pablo, North American musician, composer, and resident of Havana, Cuba since 1966.
The one hard shock that we are confronting is the lack of antibiotics, especially the components needed to manufacture them. There have also been many difficult moments in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the lack of even simple swabs. Swabs used to do the PCR test. These could be obtained easily if we were not blockaded. Even the glass materials essential for these exams are very difficult to obtain. Norma, psychologist from Cuba.
The financial reserves robbed from our nation are not available for the maintenance and replacement of parts for a water system. This results sometimes in failures of the distribution of water for months, resulting in people being forced to walk long distances carrying water. This harms the health, hygiene, and economy.
Water supply depends on electricity to run the water pumps. When the power comes on, we rush home to turn on the faucet to fill the bathtub with water.
Gasoline is often not available because the US-EU sanctions prohibit Syria from importing crude oil to refine into gasoline. A taxi ride, which used to cost 100 lira, now costs 1,000. People wait days in line at the gas stations to fill up their cars, and the amount is rationed due to low supply. Syria had produced and refined their own oil from domestic wells. However, the largest oil field at Al Omar near Deir Ezzor is occupied by the U.S.-backed SDF. They steal the oil, and they have a contract with Delta Crescent Energy, a U.S. firm.
We wish to live peacefully. This is the view of the majority of the Syrians.
We want the American people to stand with us. We don't deserve this.
We want the American people to stand with us. We don't deserve this.
We want the American people to stand with us. We don't deserve this. Rana in Damascus.
Those were voices from some of the 39 nations, more than a third of the world's population, now subjected to unilateral coercive measures, also known as sanctions. You can read and download the full report at sanctionskill.org. On September 17, President Joe Biden issued, quote, executive order on imposing sanctions on certain persons with respect to the humanitarian and human rights crisis in Ethiopia. The document itself said that the Treasury Department would be able to impose sanctions on, quote, any government entity or political party, meaning most obviously the Ethiopian and Eritrean governments, which U.S. and allied officialdom and their stenographic press have vilified since the first week of November 2020. That's when the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked a federal army base, and the federal army had the audacity to respond, even though the TPLF is a long-standing U.S. ally. Cries of Tigray genocide appeared on social media the same day. USAID Chief Samantha Power and friends launched a crusade for censure, sanctions, maybe even military intervention. The TPLF carried their war across the border from Tigray region into Amhara region, but the suffering of the Amhara has not entered the official narrative. I spoke to Jamal Countess, photographer and human rights investigator, on the ground in Amhara.
I am currently between Bahardar and Gondar, and I am documenting the IDP situation and interviewing IDPs who have been made IDPs either due to the war itself or the latest round of TPLF aggression and invasion into the Amhara region.
And what are you seeing there where you are?
I've been covering IDPs in Ethiopia since the start of this war over the course of several trips. And what I'm seeing with this trip is widespread trauma. Honestly, having grown up in an environment that was quasi-military and knowing a lot of vets and a lot of people who have been through traumatic situations, I'm seeing a lot of severe trauma in people from young children to adults to the elderly. It's just people are really beyond shell-shocked about having to leave their homes, witnessing their loved ones being killed, being brutalized, and having to walk sometimes 2 to 3 weeks to get to a safe place. So it's mind-boggling. You can think that you've been a photographer for 30-some years and you've seen things, and my colleagues who cover war on a regular will talk to you about things that they see, but this is surreal.
And these are largely ethnic Amhara fleeing the Tigray People's Liberation Front?
Yes, mainly, I would say, 95% Amhara. I did speak to several Ago people yesterday, which technically we can say are Amhara as well, even though the TPLF tried their best to cause division between the different ethnic groups. The Ago are a smaller ethnicity, but technically are still Amhara. And I hope that my Ethiopian listeners will forgive me if I'm slightly off on that. But the way it's explained to me is that they are Amhara as well.
And how far into Amhara are the TPLF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, from Tigray? How much of Amhara have they penetrated?
Well, they tried to penetrate on several fronts, Afar, Walkite, and this region, which is Gondar / North Gondar, Wallo. I don't have a map in front of me, but I can tell you that there's almost like a finger or a bulge that extends out from the Tigray border that encompasses Raya, Kobo, Lalibela, and I want to say Waldia, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a significant portion, a narrow, bulging, finger-like portion that extends into the Amhara region.
From Tigray?
From Tigray, yeah.
Okay, tell us about Lalibela.
Lalibela, as most people, I hope, would know, is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's home to 11 rock-hewn churches that were built by King Lalibela in the 12th, 13th century, and is known around the world as a major site in the Orthodox Christian and beyond world. It's the place where I started a lot of my research into Eastern religion. It's a place where I met the woman who became my wife. I have several friends in the priesthood and the general populace from Lalibela, and right now it's been occupied by the TPLF for over a month.
Okay. It seems like the TPLF may be using Lalibela, this precious World Heritage Site, sort of like human shields, because the Ethiopian Defense Forces won't want to fire on them there and risk damaging the churches.
Yes, well, it's a multifaceted situation. I'm basing my information off of two separate interviews with IDPs from Lalibela. When the TPLF entered Lalibela, first they attempted to install mortars on the grounds of the churches. The priest of the churches argued against that, and actually four young men died in a series of arguments at a church called Medhani Elam, which is the largest of the rock-hewn churches. Mm-hmm. So they relocated the mortars and then later the heavy artillery to areas adjacent to the churches, so that even best efforts and the most precise military strikes would still cause significant damage to the grounds around the churches, if not the churches themselves. There is the first church built by King Lalibela is in a mountain called Ashatan Mariam with two other churches. Mm-hmm. The TPLF have fortified that mountain peak, which basically gives you at least a 10-mile range of visibility over the entire area. The family I spoke to yesterday said that there were heavy machine guns at Naktalab, which is one of the most cherished monasteries in the region. In addition to that, when the TPLF entered Lalibela, in typical fashion, they were preceded by their child soldiers, children ages 13 to 15, then the regular cadre, and then another group of individuals who were responsible primarily for taking looted items back to Tigray.
Items looted from the churches?
Items looted from the entire town. When they came into Lalibela, they told the world, we're just here as a peaceful occupation. But according to the witnesses that I interviewed, They took ambulances, medical supplies, money. They looted the banks. They looted the local government buildings. Whatever they did not loot, they burned and destroyed. And food resources have been allocated specifically to the TPLF. And the general population, whoever did not leave, who's still there, they get basically the crumbs or what's left, if they get that.
Okay, you mean the crumbs of what's left
after the TPLF eats, yes.
Okay, but on the food aid coming in these
there's no
massive...
food aid. There's no food aid getting into Lalibela because Lalibela is occupied.
Okay.
Lalibela is being turned into what Monte Cassino was during World War II. It's being turned into a fortress.
Okay. So what about the food aid trucks going in? I mean, it's just bizarre. 428 of 466 have reportedly disappeared, and the UN says they don't know where they are.
Yeah, we're stepping onto this really volatile ground of just who's complicit with aiding and abetting the TPLF war effort. Over 460 food trucks, massive flatbed trucks go into Tigray, 38 come out. And people say they don't know where they are. They, in the age of satellite tracking and GPS, nobody knows where they are or the drivers who took those trucks there. Then on the flip side, we do see these military offenses being conducted by the TPLF where they are ferrying massive amounts of troops to the front.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a coincidence or by design or who knows? I mean, I'll leave it up to you and your listeners.
What about the 7 UN aid workers who were expelled this week? That was all over the Western press, too.
Well, a good amount of information has been made available on social media as to some of the behaviors of these 7 individuals. And the Ethiopian government, I saw, released a press release on the reasons why they were expelled.
Mm-hmm.
And they relate to aiding and abetting the TPLF war effort. Mm-hmm. And also disseminating false information. I mm-hmm. actually read one of the Twitter posts of one of the men who was expelled. And mm-hmm. he basically on his Twitter feed stated that the Ethiopian government attacked the government of Tigray to remove the government of Tigray. Then the government of Tigray started response with the Northern Command attacks, which I think anybody who knows the situation is completely false. It's a bold lie. We all know that the Northern Command attacks started on November 3rd into November 4th, and they were a preemptive strike by the TPLF. The TPLF actually admitted that. So you have individuals who basically were less than honest about their activities and actually were TPLF loyalists, if not direct members of the TPLF.
Okay, how many IDPs would you say there are there in the region where you are?
Where I am right now, I am working amongst scattered camps containing up to 300,000 IDPs.
Wow.
And we're not hearing anything about this because of the relationship TPLF has with the Western establishment and Western media and the network that the TPLF established when they were in power, where in which they control the narrative and have controlled it for several years.
And what would you say the story is?
I said the story is 1 million people traumatized not only by war, but by the confusion and the vitriol coming from the West. I was at an IDP camp yesterday, and I was documenting an aid organization, a local aid organization, feeding people at this IDP camp. And when the guy heard that I was American, he said, I don't want to talk to him. And so my escorts had to explain, like, no, he is here for you. He's here to talk about the IDP situation. He is basically a neutral, objective journalist. Mm-hmm. And so then the guy, he opened up to me. You know, mm-hmm. we talked him off the ledge, but, you know, he basically said, I don't even want to hear the word America because Americans have done so much damage to this situation and you have aided and abetted the TPLF. We lived under the TPLF for 27 years. We saw them disappear 2 million Amhara. We saw them commit atrocities. We've seen them do so much, basically form this ethnic apartheid system. And then the Americans, because of this whole Black Hawk Down relationship that they started with the TPLF, Americans want to maintain that relationship and see them come back into power. The U.S. has aided and abetted the TPLF. We helped to train their Agassi troops for goodness sakes. We have done so much for them, and that was because of what Meles promised during the War on Terror. But the U.S. turned a blind eye when Meles turned all of those resources on the destruction and subjugation of anybody that was not ethnic Tigrayan in Ethiopia. So it's actually shameful that we stand as this pillar of human rights in X, Y, and Z. And we supported somebody who basically helped to destroy multiple millions of lives in his own country.
Okay, and is there anything else you'd like to say?
I would like to tell people to educate themselves on the situation in Ethiopia, to educate themselves as to who the TPLF actually are, and to understand, take it from somebody who has been to Maikadra, who has been to Humera, somebody who lived in Ethiopia for years during the TPLF reign, and who saw the transition into the Abiy government, that you're dealing with a group that is maniacal and diabolical and has tight control over the media narrative because they formed a massive media network with partners in Ethiopia and outside of Ethiopia to control the narrative to assure their position in power.
Okay, and just to be totally straightforward here, you are from Brooklyn.
I'm actually from Baltimore. I lived in Brooklyn for 20 some years, but I was doing research for a book I was writing, and I went to Lalibela in 2013, and that's when I met most of the people who are my friends now, mm-hmm. and actually also the woman who became my wife. She is ethnic Oromo and Amhara. I have a cousin that lives in Mekelle, who I actually went to see when I was able to go to Mekelle in June. We live in a multi-ethnic family. Mm-hmm. Ethiopians are by and large mixed people. Oromo Amhara, Amhara Tigre, Oromo Tigre, etc. so forth, you know, Gambala Amhara. Mm-hmm. And so this whole ethnic-based identity and this ethnic concept is completely destructive. So my allegiance is to God first and to human rights and justice for anybody. And what's happening here is just based solely on wanting to see justice in Ethiopia for Ethiopians.
Okay, Jamal Countess, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thanks for having me.
That was photographer and human rights investigator Jamal Countess on the ground in Ethiopia's Amhara region. Last week, the World Food Program acknowledged that 428 of 466 massive flatbed trucks full of food aid have inexplicably disappeared into Tigray region since July 12. Nevertheless, the WFP keeps demanding more trucks for Tigray, but none for Amhara. International financial authorities have already destroyed Ethiopia's credit rating as the U.S. threatens more extreme economic sanctions.
Bring tears, bring suffering to my people. I send a to them.
That was IMF by Seyun Kuti. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel addressed the United Nations General Assembly by video from Havana on the 23rd of September this year. He denounced not only the U.S. blockade of Cuba, but also the unilateral coercive measures applied to other countries who dare to challenge the so-called rule-based order dictated by Washington and its allies.
Señor Presidente, bajo el liderazgo y con la instigación permanente de los Estados Unidos, se está promoviendo un peligroso cisma internacional con el pernicioso uso y abuso.
Mr. President, a dangerous international schism, permanently headed and instigated by the United States, is being promoted through the pernicious use and abuse of economic coercive measures, which have become the instrument defining the foreign policy of the United States. The government of that country threatens, extorts, and pressures sovereign states so that they speak and act against those it has identified as adversaries. It forces its allies to create coalitions to overthrow legitimate governments, break trade agreements, abandon and prohibit certain technologies, and adopt unjustified judicial measures against citizens from the countries that refuse to submit. It often uses the term international community to refer to the small group of governments that tend to irretrievably follow Washington's dictates. The rest of the countries, which account for the overwhelming majority of this organization, seem to have no place in the international community definition advocated by the United States. It is a kind of behavior associated with ideological and cultural intolerance, with a remarkable racist influence and hegemonic ambition. It is neither possible nor acceptable to identify the right of a nation to economic and technological development as a threat, nor is it possible to question the right of every state to develop the political, economic, and social and cultural system that has been sovereignly chosen by its people. In short, today we are witnessing the implementation of unacceptable political practices in the international context that go against the universal commitment to uphold the Charter of the United Nations, including the sovereign right to self-determination. Independent and sovereign states are being driven under multiple pressures to force them to subordinate to the will of Washington and to an order based on its capricious rules.
Señor presidente, durante más de 60 años, el gobierno de Estados Unidos no ha cesado ni un minuto en sus ataques contra Cuba. Pero en este momento crucial y desafiante para todas las naciones...
Mr. President, for more than 60 years, the U.S. government has not ceased for a single minute in its attacks against Cuba. However, at this crucial and challenging moment for all nations, its aggressiveness exceeds all limits. The most cruel and longest-lasting economic, commercial, and financial blockade ever applied against any nation has been opportunistically and criminally tightened during the pandemic, and the current Democratic administration maintains unchanged the 243 coercive measures adopted by the Donald Trump administration, including Cuba's inclusion in the spurious and immoral list of countries allegedly sponsoring terrorism. It is in this context that an unconventional war is launched against our country, to which the U.S. government has allocated, in a public and notorious manner, millions through manipulation campaigns and lies, with the use of the new information technologies and other digital platforms in order to portray, internally and externally, an absolutely false image of the Cuban reality, destabilize and discredit the country, and vindicate the change of regime doctrine. They have done everything to erase the Cuban Revolution from the political map of the world. They accept no alternatives to the model they can see for their own backyard. Their plan is perverse and incompatible with the democracy and freedom they advocate. But our enemies must be clear that we will not give away the homeland and revolution that several generations of patriots bequeathed to us by standing their ground. Today, I would like to reiterate before the respectable and real community of nations that every year votes, almost unanimously, against the blockade, what Army General Raul Castro expressed some years ago. Cuba is not afraid of lies, nor does it give in to pressures, conditions, or impositions wherever they may come from. Mr. President, we are not daunted by the colossal challenges. We will continue to create for Cuba. We offer selfless solidarity to those who need our support, and we also gratefully receive it from friendly governments and peoples and the Cuban community abroad. I would like to take this opportunity to thank you all for your support at this juncture, which dignifies humanity, values, and unconditional international cooperation without any interference. Mr. President, we ratify Cuba's determination to continue speaking the truth in a transparent way. However, much of this might be upsetting to some, defending the principles and values we believe in, supporting just causes, confronting violations as much as we have confronted foreign aggressions, colonialism, racism, apartheid, and struggling ceaselessly for the greatest possible justice, prosperity, and development of our peoples, who deserve a better world. Thank you very much.
Y desarrollo de nuestros pueblos que merecen un mundo mejor. Muchas gracias.
That was Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel speaking at the UN General Assembly on September 23rd. Special thanks to Alex Kane Shapiro at KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Special thanks to Linda Perry, Annette Aguilar, Julian Omotoso, Lisa Davis, and Gwen DeBrow. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Ann Garrison.
Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Helena Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.